amounts of radioactive iodine are released into the atmosphere, which are then readily absorbed into the body. Medical Corps' potassium iodate gives you virtually complete protection from the most feared consequence of a nuclear accident, radioactive poisoning. Potassium iodate can protect against radioactive poisoning by filling the thyroid with good iodine. This shields the thyroid and prevents it from absorbing the harmful.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those views of Chris Farrell from Judicial Watch back in Washington, D.C. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what they were able to discover about the talking points that were used by Henry Paulson when he got the leaders of some nine banks in to try to convince them they had to take the troubled asset relief program financing. Now, remember, this is they called the TARP financing. The government said, oh, we got a terrible crisis. You got to give us $700 billion so that we can help the homeowners. And then and when they got the $700 billion, they decided to change their mind and give the money to the banks. But did the banks really want the money? Did they need the money? Was there really the crisis that we were told? Well, Chris and his organization were under the Freedom of Information Act to get information on the talking points that were drawn up for the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, who incidentally had made between $700 and $800 million as CEO of Goldman Sachs and had given that fabulous salary for a $180,000 a year job as Secretary of the Treasury. What an idealist! I mean, how many of you would give up a job that was paying you $35 million a year to take a job paying $180,000 a year? He must be a real patriot. Well, let's get into the story with Chris Farrell, because I want to hear what he has to say. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing, Dr. Stan?
I'm doing fine. Why don't you go ahead and give us the background of what you and Judicial Watch have found. And first of all, why don't you tell our listeners who Judicial Watch is and why your work's so important, and then what you found out about
the
talking
point. Sure. I'd be happy to do so. Of course, Judicial Watch has been around for 15 years now. We're founded as a government watchdog group. Our sort of mission statement is that we promote transparency, integrity, and accountability in government, politics, and the law.
That sounds like President Obama.
There we go, transparency, Mr. Transparency. It's what he talks about a lot. Of course, what we do is try to uncover all those things that the government doesn't want you to know. We ask all those inconvenient, awkward questions, and we often sue. We go into court to either compel the production of records and documents that we've requested under the law, because the government's first response is usually no. They don't like turning things over, because the great unwashed masses aren't allowed to know what's going on very often. And, of course, we also bring lawsuits on constitutional questions and on major issues really affecting the rule of law, when there's out-of-control local governments that are refusing to comply with federal law, or vice versa, when there's federal agencies that are overstepping themselves. We insert ourselves and try to bring about some justice and try to represent the average American. With respect to the banking crisis, I'm using air quotes when I say banking crisis, but the effort on the part of at first the Bush administration and then later enhanced by the Obama administration to force money and take up for the government to take up equity stakes in various banks around the country. There was this big meeting back on October 16th, 2008. I'm sure folks will remember. And when they had that meeting, we wanted to get the minutes of it. And we asked for the minutes, and the first response from the Treasury Department was, we have no record of the meeting.
Okay, I want you to hold that thought there, Chris, because we're going to actually bring another station on board. And,
sure.
And we certainly want them to hear what you have to say. And I think it's so important for the public to realize that they do not want the public to know the truth.
No.
And they will lie. They will go to any ends to conceal what's really happening.
They do it all the time.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Crystal Farrell from Judicial Watch. That's Chris Farrell from Judicial Watch. And they're back in the Washington, D.C. area. They're a public interest watchdog group that, of course, tries to get information from government, tries to find out the things that the government doesn't want people to know. Now, one of the biggest, I won't call it a swindle, let's say one of the biggest mistakes Congress ever made was in return for bribes of about $150 billion, that was B, billion, boy, horrific, $150 billion, why Congress changed its vote between the end of September and the 3rd of October of last year and voted to authorize the TARP funds. They're referred to as the Troubled Asset Relief Program funds. And, of course, it was because they wanted it. We were told the money was going to be given to Main Street to keep people in their homes. The money was not going to go to Wall Street, to the big banks. Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, went on radio and television and insisted the money is for Main Street. We want to help people. They're losing their homes, foreclosures. Do you want to see this happen? Do you want to see children thrown out on the street? No, this money is to help the people. It's not for Wall Street. And then when they got the $700 billion, after offering $150 billion in bribes, well, they don't call it bribes, these were just various projects that the congressmen wanted to get for their districts. Why, of course, then, why they gave the money to the Wall Street banks. But the interesting thing was that the Wall Street banks really didn't need or want the money. This is what most people don't know. So there were some talking points that were laid out by Henry Paulson as he got, I think, the leaders of 9 major banks into a room, locked the door, and told them they had to take the money. In other words, we certainly didn't want to give it to those common people who, you know, were losing their homes. We were going to give it to Wall Street, even if they didn't want it. You pick up the story there, Chris. Chris was trying to, through Judicial Watch, was trying to find out the minutes of the meeting. And of course, when they contacted the Treasury Department, they said, we have no record of the meeting.
That's what didn't pass the giggle test on our side of the equation. We had made use of the Freedom of Information Act and requested the meeting minutes themselves and any of the other materials they had. Certainly, if you're going to have the CEOs, presidents, chairmen of the 9 largest banks in the country, to meet with the Treasury Secretary and Bernanke, the Fed chairman, and the rest, and they're going to engage in a financial transaction.
Hold that thought for just a moment.
Sure.
Here. Well, Chris is describing what's going to happen. Certainly there's going to be a meeting. The Secretary of the Treasury is going to be there. Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve System, is going to be there. And the CEO of the 9 largest banks in the country are going to be attending this meeting, this closed meeting, closed door. Well, actually, I've heard that they actually locked the door so the bank presidents couldn't get out. But Chris wanted to know, and Judicial Watch wanted to know, what happened at the meeting. So after initially saying there was no record of the meeting and everybody knew, all you had to do was read the newspaper, of course there was a meeting. Pick up the story there, Chris.
Sure. Well, we used the Freedom of Information Act to make the request for the records of the meeting. The initial response from the Treasury Department is that they had no responsive records. As I mentioned just a moment ago, that didn't pass the giggle test. It's impossible to think that the 9 largest banks would meet with the senior financial officers of the government, that there'd be no record, and that, essentially what came out of this meeting was the single largest financial transaction in the history of man, and somehow there was no paper, not a single scrap. I mean, it was preposterous. But that was the position of the Treasury Department because, for the most part, as you've said before, our government is incredibly arrogant and disconnected from the people they're supposed to be serving. So we sued them because that's, frankly, the only way to get their attention because of their arrogance and their sort of dismissive attitude when it comes to accountability. So when we got into a federal court, the Treasury Department reversed its position magically and produced records to us. And of those records, you mentioned in passing the CEO talking points, and that's a document that's drafted for Hank Paulson to make his presentation to the bank CEOs on October 13th at the big meeting. And when you read through the talking points, Paulson makes it very, very clear. He does not even leave open the possibility, the option, that the CEOs would not take money or that they would take less money than Treasury had allocated to dole out to them. And the language that he used is quite threatening because he says, look, quote, if a capital infusion is not appealing, you should be aware your regulator will require it in any circumstance. And there's additional language in the talking points and briefing that makes it sound like, look, if you say no and try to leave here, we're going to destroy you. I mean, that's essentially the message.
But I think, Chris, I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that we were told that the reason that the economy was collapsing at that time was because the banks didn't have any money to loan. The banks were desperate for money. They were holding all of these so-called toxic assets, these CDOs and SIBs and ABSs and all this alphabet soup sort of things, designed specifically to confuse people. But we were told that the reason there was a problem was the banks were desperate for money, and that's why the Treasury was going to offer it to them. But it would appear that a lot of the banks didn't want the government's money. Was that the impression you got?
Yes, it's clearly what comes across, because there's this not-so-thinly-veiled threat that if they attempted to reject or reduce the amount of money that was being compelled upon them, that they would go out and destroy the bank through the press. And all you need to do is have the Treasury Secretary walk out of that meeting and have a press conference and say, well, you know, Bank X, fill in the blank, whatever title you want, Bank X has decided not to participate, and we have grave concerns about that bank. Therefore, we're going to have a regulatory team descend upon the bank and basically take it apart, examining its books and scrutinizing and auditing and surveying the bank. That would send a message that would effectively destroy that institution. There's no way the next morning at 9 a.m. everybody and his mother wouldn't line up to pull their money out of that bank, either as small individual account holders or larger institutional players. They would all back out because the message would be sent by the Treasury Secretary, these guys are either insolvent or they're going to come under such a degree of scrutiny and so much regulatory control that it's going to crush the bank itself.
Well, so, of course, the banks weren't insolvent. If they were insolvent, they'd be desperate to get the money, but they weren't desperate to get the money. That's the thing.
That is true, but the facts, don't confuse us with the facts, Dr. Stan. They have a separate agenda that they're running in this regard. And so there's these CEO talking points that are quite threatening, that are very clearly, either you play ball and take the money, or we're going to destroy your institution. I mean, that's when you cut through all the pleasantries and the double talk and the happy language, that's the two options that are left to the CEOs.
And they've got the door locked. The CEOs are told they're not going to get out unless they agree to take the money. And then, of course, they're told, in essence, they're going to be destroyed unless they take the government's money. Well, if there was this real crisis, and the banks needed the money, why didn't they tell Congress? But they didn't tell Congress. They told Congress they were going to use it to help the people. They were going to help Main Street. They were going to help the homeowners. And they simply lied about it. But when they wrote the legislation, why, of course, they forgot to put in this legislation for seven $100 billion, how Henry Paulson was to use the money. And because, of course, they did not stipulate how it could be used, he could use it for whatever he wanted to do, but don't feel bad. When Henry Paulson gave all that money to the banks so they could start lending again, they did start lending. They lent money to China. They lent money to India. They lent money to Dubai. They lent money to Spain. But they didn't have any money to lend here in the United States to stop the destruction of our economic system. So pick up the story there, Chris,
sure,
because this is so incredible.
In this case, you've got, you know, originally the whole idea is, well, we're going to flood the banks with some liquidity to loosen credit or to keep credit flowing so that you didn't create a credit crisis that would impact on the mortgage industry. Because if you roll this all back, if you peel away the layers of onion, you get to a hyperinflated home mortgage system manufactured in September of 1999 by people like Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, where they decided to take a social engineering project out at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and say that, well, we don't care if people don't meet the dollars and cents requirements. We want to open up lending to people who don't qualify because it makes us feel good about ourselves, and it allows even looser and freer and greater inflation when it comes to home values and the mortgage industry, with low doc or no doc loans going out the door like mad, with very complex financing instruments, derivative type a bundling of home mortgages that are sold at incredibly leveraged rates or amounts. So it's a very, it's a Ponzi scheme to a certain degree, but it's sort of a, you know, people were just floating paper, paper written on paper written on paper with no real valued asset tied to it or keyed to it. And, I mean, that's at the root of all of this. And so the idea to fix that is, well, an infusion of liquidity would lower the sort of anxiety level about all these lousy, dirty loans that were made, free up credit, and kind of keep the bubble bouncing along. Well, that simply collapsed on itself. No one was willing to buy into that sort of nonsense. The ugly reality, kind of the brutal hangover after the big binge drunk, you know, finally set in, and folks realized, holy cow, we got to make good on this. And that's how we got to the position that we're in now. What's really odd is after this meeting we've been talking about back on October 13th, they got all these banking chairman into the room and basically demanded that they take the money. You know, they filled out forms, and the forms that they filled out were called, here's the quote, major financial institution participation commitments. That's the language that they used. So major financial institution, okay, I understand that. That means big bank. Participation commitments, that's a curious formulation of words, but it's basically the, okay, we're signing up to take money form. And these forms we have on our website. You can go and look at them for yourself. They are preposterously, childishly designed. They look like grade school permission slips. I'm not kidding you. Where literally the bank CEOs, in their own handwriting, have scribbled in the name of their bank, how many billions of dollars they're going to take, and then they print their name at the bottom and sign it. It's as though you're signing a slip to let your kid go off to the zoo with his class. And this was the fiduciary document. These were the commitment documents, the legally binding commitments for hundreds of billions of dollars to be moved around. And quite a scam. And when you look at the documents themselves, I mean, you're almost ashamed. This is the best the Treasury Department could do.
And this was $125 billion that they were going to give to the banks. Now, did the banks have anything to say about how much they could get, or could they have all they wanted?
You know, it isn't entirely clear. When you take the whole thing in context, it appears that they essentially had a set value or numbers assigned to them. So whether it was, you know, Bank of America or Citibank or any of the big banks, you know, the number was you're going to take your pick, $15, $20, $25 billion apiece. And what these really amounted to is that, you know, these multi-billion-dollar amounts are preferred shares in the banks that are going to be issued to the government. It's the semi or the quasi nationalization of all of these banks. There's the dirty little secret.
Well, where did this $700 billion come from? Where did all this money come from?
Well, I mean, it's really you and me, but it really just comes from printing presses they keep printing.
And, of course, this is the thing. I mean, you can't spend money you don't have. Oh, yes, you can spend the money you don't have if you work for the government.
Well, the Chinese keep paying for it, yeah.
And, of course, here with this, all this money, in fact, they've created trillions of dollars. Some people say somewhere up to 10, some people say up to $14 trillion, or at least guarantees. Where's the money coming from? That's the entire gross domestic product of our entire country over a full year. And yet, of course, they're spending money like a drunken sailor, or as someone said, don't insult drunken sailors. We'll be back in just a moment. You go right ahead and pick the story up there, Chris.
Sure.
No, go right ahead. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead. Don't be bashful.
Okay. I wasn't sure if we were going to a break. I'm sorry. I think that the... with respect to what happened after that, once they've executed these forms, I think is relatively well known, and I think it's notorious in the fact that nothing happened. There was no appreciable outcome or result or sudden turnaround in either the market or, let alone Wall Street, but even on Main Street, there was no dramatic shift that suddenly reduced the burdens in the home lending industry or the rate of foreclosures, and I think what it really did was put the Treasury further in debt to Beijing. I mean, that's probably the greatest accomplishment out of this entire enormous multi-billion-dollar transaction.
But of course, the thing that really disturbs me, Chris, is they did not increase or start a massive lending to people. In fact, that people were beginning to have difficulty getting loans. Certainly, they could lend money overseas, but they just didn't have any money to lend here to major corporations in the United States, dependent upon the ready availability of credit to survive. And so we saw suddenly more and more of our major corporations just collapsing.
Yeah, and there's a very sophisticated public relations effort that was put into play by the Bush White House to tamp down any concern about the notion that the banks are going to be nationalized. There are some emails that we obtained, and again, they're available on our website, showing that there was some folks in the Bush administration reaching out to who they thought would be allies, but they were concerned that they might express reservations or concern. And I'm speaking about, people at the Heritage Foundation, those sorts of organizations, conservative think tanks who normally, if it was any other administration, would jump up and down and scream about nationalizing banks. But since it was the Bush administration in the closing days of their swan song, and there was such fear and such crisis mentality that was being generated, they didn't want any sort of contrary opinions or any concern being expressed. So they went into quite a high level of RPMs trying to spin up enough sort of calm or an effort to tamp down any concern about this nationalization of the banks. Curiously, it also shows in some of the emails that Paulson was able to brief Barack Obama about what was going on at the bankers' meeting. But curiously, the man who supposedly suspended his campaign to race back to the Capitol to calm things down and work out a solution, Senator McCain, Paulson wasn't able to contact him. And so there's records we have, these email records, where Paulson has at least was able to brief Obama on what they were trying to accomplish. But ironically enough, no contact with McCain. Very curious little footnote of history.
Well, I think that's what's really so important. You have to have all the dots there. Maybe someday we'll be able to begin connecting them. So basically, of course, we're really talking about quasi-nationalization of the major banks, and certainly the federal government becomes really one of the major holders of preferred shares in these banks. We'll be back here in just a moment with Chris Farrell. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris is simply describing the fact that when these banks are forced to accept all this money from the federal government, much of which they really don't want, or most of the banks didn't want, but what this did, of course, the money was given in return for preferred shares for the bank, and now the federal government is becoming increasingly a large factor in taking control of the national banking system. And, of course, everything is being done to keep the American people from understanding the implications. We're nationalizing these major banks. There are 9 major banks in the United States. Most of them are called investment banks. They're not regulated by the same controls as commercial banks are, although several of the banks actually did convert themselves into commercial banks, didn't they, so they could get that real cheap money that the Fed was giving out at 0% or 1% interest.
Yes, and you know, the other thing I think is curious, or at least sort of intriguing, is that the Obama administration went to great lengths to protect the correspondence, the email back and forth of Timothy Geithner, who at the time, of course, was at the New York Federal Reserve, and his opinion and comments and input to Paulson's plans was part of the dialogue before this big meeting and subsequent to the meeting with these major bankers. And so we were very curious to see what Mr. Geithner had to say. While he was on one side of the fence, and of course now he's sitting over in Paulson's position as the Treasury Secretary, we wanted to see what he said in October versus what he says in January. And the Obama administration has done all they can, successfully so far, to withhold all the key documents concerning what Geithner's role was in the bankers' meeting.
Well, do you have any idea why that would be? What would there be in this correspondence and in these letters and emails, directives? Why would they try to conceal that from the American people?
Well, I think, of course, the excuse that they use, the formal legal answer they give to that is, well, you realize, of course, these are pre-decisional documents, and if we were to release them, they might have a chilling effect upon the ability of senior government officials to give frank advice to people prior to or leading up to a decision. But I think that there's a larger question here than that. I think in this case, this is an effort to constrain, to control, to manage the information concerning what Geithner's position may or may not have been while sitting at the New York Federal Reserve versus what he's now trying to implement as the Secretary of the Treasury.
But don't you really think, of course, Sidney, that Henry Paulson and Geithner and Ben Bernanke were certainly all working hand in hand in this whole thing? Certainly the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is one of the most powerful men in the world, and certainly he just shifts from one seat of power to another. Now he's the Secretary of the Treasury, and we still, of course, have Ben Bernanke there, you know, in a position of power. And,
yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's sort of, my friend of mine says, hamburger, cheeseburger, same smell.
Right.
It's virtually indistinguishable. But I do think that whatever his remarks or his comments, his edits were to the talking points that Paulson used, and we know that he did make edits. We just can't see what they are. I think that that provides us with sort of a glimpse or at least an insight into what the back and forth was. I mean, very often, the horse trading and the maneuvering of these various parties, they're not in lockstep. They're not necessarily always in agreement. And they do have sort of a nuanced approach or set of, sort of angled approach on how they would deal with various aspects of the crisis. And I think it's illuminating. It provides you with an insight. Certainly not knowing doesn't help us. So we're going to continue to press to get whatever documents we can out of them on this issue.
Well, I think this really is one of the most significant events that has really ever taken place, this massive transfer of money. And now, of course, there's this small little quotient, Ben Bernanke, Timothy Geithner, and, of course, the man who heads now the Federal Reserve Bank. In fact, he just happens to be from Goldman Sachs. He's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank.
Just one
there.
Second.
Anyway, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank.
My apologies. I have a very large Great Dane in the background.
That's all right.
Every once in a while, he gets a little mouthy. My apologies.
I'm sure he just wants a little attention.
Well, that's what he's doing.
I know. They're very affectionate dogs. They're really beautiful
dogs.
All right, fine. Well, of course, our guest is Chris Farrell. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two. Can you stay with us the last half hour, Chris?
I can stick with you for another segment, but I can't do a full half hour.
All right, but you stay as long as you can, and when you have to take off, you let me know. But, of course, Chris is from Judicial Watch. Chris, how can people get to your website?
Sure. The web address is Judicial Watch, all one word, judicialwatch.org, O-R-G.
That's judicialwatch.org. It's a great organization. Certainly, we've worked with them off and on ever since they've been around. So we'll be back here in just a moment to discuss about, well, certainly the fact that you're not getting the full truth from the controlled media. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Farrell from Judicial Watch, and we're just simply talking about the talking points that were utilized by Henry Paulson to really convince the people from the major banks that if they ever wanted to get out of that locked room, they're going to have to take the money. But I just can't understand why, if there was this great crisis and the banks didn't have any money to lend, they wouldn't want to, of course, take this money from the federal government. Now we know that certainly J.P. Morgan Chase, that Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have paid that money back again because they want to get out from government control and surveillance. Is that correct, Chris?
That is exactly correct, Dr. Stan. You know, the larger question that really troubles me, this one I have not been able to kind of break the code on, is, you know, it was presented to us, I think, when I say us, I mean just the average citizen, that if they didn't act on that weekend in October, on that October 13th meeting, if they didn't come out of that room with those signed agreements, you know, we were going to see the collapse of the United States. You know, the Republic was in grave danger. That's the way it was presented. At least that was my inference, my take on the situation, that we were facing a crisis, you know, short of war, but certainly a very grave set of circumstances economically. And there was a lot of, I think, hyperbolic language. There was a lot of spin, a lot of manipulation, and you know, it came and went, and then they came around for a second bite at the apple and another multi-billion-dollar transfer, all of course financed by Beijing ultimately, and you know, it hasn't happened. Now, certainly we're in rough economic conditions. There's a lot of problems in the country with respect to that on both sides of the economic equation, but I mean, I just think we were sold a bill of goods. I think there was a lot of dishonest sort of bums rush approach to this, and that's what's really most disturbing. I think the American public has been lied to in a particularly underhanded, devious way, and that's why we are so determined to get as much and as many of these documents as we can to expose or at least create some sort of a documentary record or history as to what really happened.
Well, I'm really so glad that you're getting that information because it certainly helps me as I try, of course, reaching out across America 5 hours every day to let the American people know that things are not as they appear to be. In fact, as we always say, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And hopefully you're going to help us to get to the reality. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Farrell from Judicial Watch. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, since, of course, October of last year, when this meeting took place on the 13th of October, why, you know, millions of people have lost their jobs since that time. Certainly, probably close to 2.5 million people have lost their homes since that time. I mean, this has been one of the greatest economic catastrophes of modern times. And, of course, the question is, why won't the major banks lend? Why are they cutting off credit lines to many of our industries and small businesses? And certainly, why is the Federal Reserve System, for the first time in history, paying interest on the reserves that are deposited with them, so that many of the banks, rather than loan money out when they're not sure they're going to get it back, are giving money to the Federal Reserve and simply drying up the money that the small banks could or should be lending. And certainly the small banks are putting all of their money with the Federal Reserve. It's much safer there than lending it out at uncertain times, but it's because they're getting paid interest, which they've never gotten before. I've never understood why that would be, Chris. Are you aware of the fact the Federal Reserve is paying the bank's interest on the money that it deposited with them for the reserve requirements?
No, I'm not. I mean, that's news to me. I think one thing I found curious is that while the Treasury Department was reaching out and telling these nine big banks that they must appear, there's and I don't recall the exact name, so forgive me, but there is an association of small independent community banks, and that association represents literally community banks, county banks, town banks, and not the big behemoths, the big monster banks. But let me tell you, these community banks, these small business banks, also have billions of dollars in assets. And the leader, the president of that association, wrote to Paulson and sort of said, hey, I hear you're having all the big guys in for a meeting. What about us? And his request or his comment to participate or at least to audit the meeting was rejected. So I found that quite curious, very interesting.
Well, I think there are a lot of very, very strange things. And certainly the thing is that an industrialized society such as ours is dependent upon the ready availability of credit. And suddenly it's just almost as if somebody had turned off the spigot and credit and loans are not available. And then we see many of our major retailers going down. We see so many of our businesses going down. And now we find so many of our hotels are losing money that you're certainly talking already about millions of more people losing their homes because they've lost their jobs. And we don't see any end in sight of the present time until credit becomes readily available. And it seems that the major banks won't loan, and the small banks, many of them, are afraid to loan.
Yeah, and as you said, I just don't see a significant shift anywhere soon. Biden's comment of a day or two ago, where he said, hey, look, basically, you know, we misjudged this. We didn't understand all the implications of what this was going to do and how it was going to play out. Maybe so, but I don't know that that's the answer. I don't know that that's sort of spontaneous confession or outburst.
Well, that really doesn't give you a very good feeling of confidence when the Vice President of the United States, supposedly a member of this smartest people in the world, admits, well, we really made a mistake here. We didn't understand what was going on. So what is their solution? Well, of course, we got into this problem because we had excessive debt, we had excessive spending, we had excessive consumption. And what are they pushing? Why more debt, more consumption?
Yeah, they're going to spend their way out. I mean, it's just... I any number of different ideas about sort of the collapse of the British Empire come to mind in our own circumstances.
Well, of course, Zimbabwe tried to do this. It didn't work very well. The Weimar Republic tried to do it, but it's been tried dozens of times down throughout history, and it just doesn't work. And I don't know why, just because we have these smart people in Washington, D.C., we would think we would be able to repeal the laws of finance. What do you hear back there? Because you're in Washington, D.C., and meeting people within the conservative movement. What is their attitude towards the policies of the Obama administration?
You know, frankly, I think there are an awful lot of people that you would normally consider to be sort of within the conservative leadership that are remarkably silent. They'll throw out a critique of, gee, things aren't turning out the way the Obama administration thought they were going to turn out, and certainly that's true, and that's sort of a master of the obvious type statement. But I don't really hear a well-articulated, well-reasoned alternative argument presented. And I think that's really, that is the shame, really, within the conservative movement, that there, at least in my view, my own personal assessment, there's no one who's saying, well, this is not the way to go, but the right way to go is to follow A, B, and C. Now, maybe there is someone out there doing that, and I'm not hearing them, or maybe it's not translating in my brain very well, But I just don't see a clear, well-articulated, well-reasoned alternative being offered.
Well, I think, of course, what I think a lot of people like Peter Schiff and Gerald Celente and certainly the people that I'm reading are saying, look, we've had excess, we've had a paper economy, we've had a fiat money system. Going back to 1971, and the whole thing has collapsed. We knew it was going to collapse. Let it collapse, and then let's get back to a solid currency with some restrictions on the ability of government to create money out of nothing and start in all over again by just simply printing money and spending money and borrowing money. You're only going to prolong the agony it's going to drag on instead of for six months as it did back in 1921 after the First World War. Or it did after the 1921, of course, they let it collapse and they came back and 6 months later they're in good shape. But certainly during the Great Depression of 1929, it continued right up until 1941. We weren't out of the Depression. We still had something like 15% unemployment immediately before the attack on Pearl Harbor. It was only the war that got us out of the mess because they used all the same policies that the Obama administration is using.
Yeah, and you know, I've just finished reading a book by a woman named Amity Schles called The Forgotten Man, and it's sort of a reevaluation or reassessment of the whole FDR New Deal, socialist approach to the Depression. And she points out quite clearly that, there's 29, and everyone knows about that. But there was a depression inside of the depression. And in 1937, 5 years into FDR, and supposedly while we were in the middle of our recovery, quote-unquote, the economy collapsed again in 37. All the schemes and the alphabet soup worth of agencies and programs were for naught. And the only thing, as you just mentioned, the only thing that even hauled us out of that was the Second World War, because it essentially reset the entire world's economy, like a circuit breaker. The extraordinary circumstances of the war changed the complexion of everything. And I'm really at a loss. And the book, The Forgotten Man, is quite good, very interesting, well done. I don't say it's authoritative or the last word, but it certainly is a very interesting read and well written. And some important facts came out that, frankly, I had not considered, I had not evaluated in that light. And the alternative for a lot of folks now is saying, well, Obama's not going far enough. Obama should do even more. He should follow even a more aggressive socialist path. And that, to me, just seems, it just runs contrary to everything that I've and heard so far.
Well, you know, of course, there's an amazing article that's up on Pravda recently, written by one of the leaders of the Russian government, who's saying, the America is embracing Marxism. It doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. We've had this command control of the economy here in Russia for years, and it led to total collapse. If America goes the way we did, she will collapse as well. And, when you see something like that coming out of Pravda, you can't help but wonder, what in heaven's name are our leaders thinking about? And we know command economy doesn't work. In fact, over in China, they've certainly went to the free enterprise system because communism is a failure. And yet, of course, we've moved to nationalize the banks. We've moved to nationalize the automotive companies. We're moving to nationalize every aspect of life, the health industry, the energy industry. Everything's got to be under government control. Do we really think that the new CEO of General Motors, who was appointed by the Obama administration, Barack Obama has never had a job working in a factory. He has never, of course, had to meet a payroll. And are we to expect
he's
that
he's never produced a thing in his life.
And yet he is going to be smart enough to know who we should put in charge of General Motors? Well, let's go to Dave, who's calling us from Illinois. Dave, you have a question for our guest.
I got a question for both of you, actually. Real simple. If things continue like they are doing now, if these crooked scumbags keep doing this garbage, I personally believe that we are through. I think the Dow is going to collapse. A very severe depression. I think this is inevitable, unless, you know, like Ron Paul wins. What do you guys think?
All right, fine. Let's get Chris Farrell. So,
I think we are in very grave danger. I heard a report, and I have to substantiate it. I'm not willing to assign it to the source that I heard it from yet, but I will tell you that someone within the officialdom of Washington, let's just call it that, has told me that the Bush administration, right up before this October meeting we've been discussing, had at least planned or discussed implementation of martial law in the event of this economic collapse that they were predicting. So that gives you an indication. This is a reliable source. I'm not willing to discuss who it is right now, and I need to do some more research to substantiate it. I need a confirming source. But I have reason to believe that there was at least discussion or at least planning of implementing martial law in the event that this collapse that they were worried about and they felt compelled to have this meeting over, if it had flipped over and absolute confidence had been lost and there was a run on the banks. So that gives you a measure, or at least that gives you some insight into what the thinking was here in Washington. And I think that that is a very disturbing reflection on just how bad things are, but we're kind of whistling past the graveyard.
Well, I think I would agree with you, everything you said, Dave. I think we may look back here on July of 2009 as the good old days. I think we're going into real problems. I think that the economy is going to get a lot worse later this year, but next year things are really going to get bad. It will be not until 2011 that the final wave of home foreclosures comes in. Those will be the prime loans. They're talking about, you know, probably at 30% or more of the American people losing their homes. They're talking about a real unemployment rate of maybe up to 30%. As I say, we may look back at today as the good old days. So I think we're in for real problems, but then any nation that turns against God is eventually going to, they're going to meet God's judgment, and I believe we're going to see God's judgment on America, Dave. Anything else you want to ask?
Yeah, just a comment. Guys, if we don't bring the factors back, the game's over.
All right. God bless, and thanks so much for calling, Dave. And again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, I personally don't think you can look at what's happening from a financial point of view and a political point of view unless, of course, you look at it from a spiritual point of view as well. I do believe that there are powerful spiritual forces at work behind the scenes that are manipulating us towards this destruction of our economy, and they're doing a pretty good job of it. Dave, Chris, do you have any suggestions at all?
Off the top of my head, no. I think we have some very disturbing signs. I agree with you that, you know, if we keep turning our back on what our higher power or the Lord decides we really should be doing, and we put ourselves contrary to that, whatever your particular faith or background, you can only do that for so long, and you're going to pay the piper. So the more we can comport ourselves and conform ourselves to His will, the better off we're going to be. But there's an awful lot of people who have decided that you know, they're their own God and they're going to do it their way. And that is a formula for disaster in my experience.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a
appreciate it very much. It's a great opportunity to be on, and always a pleasure, and my best to your listening audience.
God bless. And once again, that's judicialwatch.org, www.judicialwatch.org. They've got great material there.
Thanks, Dr. Stan. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Chris Farrell from Judicial Watch. We do hope that you enjoyed a conversation with him. If you have a call or any question you have, why, give us a call. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But certainly, right now, why, we're sort of in things are just sort of leveling out. Nothing's happening to the stock market. You must understand Everything is manipulated. The stock market is manipulated. The commodity market is manipulated. Gold and silver prices are manipulated. Oil prices and natural gas prices are manipulated. I mean, so there are oil tankers all over the world full of oil. There's no shortage of oil. There's no place even to unload this oil, and yet the prices went up, you know, quite high. Gasoline got over $3 of 50 cents a gallon here on the West Coast, and now it's beginning to fall. But it's all manipulated. Certainly there's excessive amounts of natural gas. They don't even know where to store it. And certainly they're manipulating down the price of gold and silver. They're maintaining the stock market. But I anticipate that probably in the next few weeks or so, it's going to begin to drop again. And the people who have been foolish enough to get into the stock market, believe me, Mr. Cramer, of course, comes from the establishment. You'll hear him on television. Comes from Goldman Sachs. And, of course, if you haven't read that wonderful article in the Rolling Stones this month on Goldman Sachs and their control of the government, you really should. But, of course, it only tells you half the story. It doesn't tell you about the Brotherhood of Darkness. It doesn't tell you that almost everybody they talk about associated with Goldman Sachs just happens to belong to the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, the CEO of Goldman Sachs just happens to be a member of the Trilateral Commission. So let's go to Rick, who's calling from Texas. This is Rick. Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Do you have a quick question?
Did your guest say they were talking about martial law?
Yeah, he was talking about martial law. He said that some very key person in Washington, D.C. had told him that the Bush administration was considering martial law. You go to my website, RadioLiberty.com, and we have actually one of our YouTube connections there under other videos, and you'll hear this congressman. And the congressmen were told if they didn't vote for the TARP legislation that Henry Paulson wanted, the troops would be in the streets on Monday. We would be under martial law. And you'll actually hear the congressman making that statement. That would be used as a threat to get through the TARP legislation so they could have their $700 billion to play with.
Well, I mean, you know how America's all spread out.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Go right ahead, Rick.
America's a really spread out country. It's not like Yugoslavia or Serbia or something like that. It's spread from, as they say, sea to shining sea. I don't see how they can really clamp down on the place.
But because basically they have the electronic ability to do it. Every home will be marked by the end of this year. We're doing the census a year early because there's a sense of urgency as they plan to establish their dictatorship. Why do you think they're getting GPS coordinates for every home in the whole world? Not just the United States, the whole world. And everybody is going to be numbered. They have dossiers on every citizen in the United States. They're collecting this information. The Defense Department is collecting it. NSA, National Security Agency, is collecting it. The FBI has dossiers on an awful lot of people. And I know I've seen my dossier, my crime. I'm a patriot. I've been trying for years to save America. And when I got my dossier, page after page after page, blacked out in the name of national security. Anything else, Rick?
If there's any jobs in the North Pole, I don't know where we can go.
There is no place. That's why we have to be involved in the battle, and we have to understand this is a spiritual battle. And we're called to do our best and to educate people about the spiritual forces that energize the David Rockefellers and the Robert McNamaras. I'm sure that hell will welcome Robert McNamara, the permanent vice chairman of the Trilateral Commission and longtime member of the Council on Foreign Relations. I bet you didn't read that in the newspaper when you read his obituary. A man who sent our boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die in Vietnam, but refused to allow them to win, and he sent them over there knowing full well this was a massive distraction so they could distract the American people and then bring in their socialist programs here in the United States.
Well, it sounds to me like they're planning on a one-world monetary system sooner rather than later.
Amen to that. We're moving fast. Hey, I got one more caller, but thanks very much, Rick. We'll talk to you later. Let's go to George calling from Pennsylvania. George, we're almost out of time. Quick question.
Obama went to see Mitsiet and Putin without a nuclear index to talk to them about nuclear proliferation. And by the way, I'm a veteran of Vietnam, and you're absolutely right. We were not allowed to win. I did three tours there.
Well, it's awful to think about the sacrifices that our boys made. And it was really all about bringing socialism and Marxism to America. It was a great diversion. The boys fought bravely, but of course, that had nothing to do with the elite's reason for the war. Hey, hang on there. We'll be back here in just a moment here. We're going to have to bring all of our stations back on board. Well, we've got George calling from Pennsylvania. George, quickly, what was your question?
Well, I don't understand why Obama took this trip to Russia to see Medvedev and Putin regarding nuclear proliferation when he doesn't even have a nuclear index of our arsenal. And what did he go to talk about, really? And I just see him doing quite a bit of things that smack of lies and subterfuge to hide the things that he's really doing.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that all of this talk is simply, it's all public relations. It's symbolism over substance. The real decisions are made behind the scenes. And remember, Obama is only a figurehead. He's a figurehead for the Trilateral Commission, who has 11 of their people in key positions in his administration, and they tell him what to do. But he's out there as the diversion while the real skullduggery is going on behind the scenes.
By the way, I also understand.
Go ahead, George. Did we lose you?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. George?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead. What'd you have
to
say?
By the way, I understand he's also constructing a new position for another czar, so that should give him 23, I believe.
I think that's more than the Russian czars had. Anyway, thanks very much. God bless. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to help us, and I know many of you are not, but if you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. You can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. You can subscribe to our newsletter, whatever you're in a position to do. And, of course, the number 1-800-544-8927. Or certainly you can go to our website at radioliberty.com. And if you look up there, you'll find that on our webpage a donate button. Press it and see what happens. And, of course, you can always donate that way. But we do hope that you'll want to get involved with us. If you want to really understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, and now a financial battlefield, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and or watch the DVD. And if you can't afford it, go to our website. We have it posted there completely free under videos. And then, of course, we hope you'll want to hear our talk on the forbidden secret, because there is a forbidden secret. It's been passed down for 5,000 years. And, of course, we hope that you'll want to find out about that, get the syllabus that goes with it, and understand that nothing is it appears to be. And, of course, many of the people in key positions of our government belong to secret societies. In fact, both George Bush and John Kerry, both running for the presidency of the United States in 2004, when asked about their membership in the Skull and Bone Society, both of them said the organization was so secret they couldn't discuss it. They had, they're running for president. What would be so secret? Why, very simply, because the Masonry Skull and Bones ties into this whole world occult movement. If you doubt that this is a Luciferian organization, go to WilliamHKennedy.com, WilliamHKennedy.com, and there you can actually see the videos that were shot at great personal danger by somebody of the initiation ceremony of Skull and Bones, which George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush and John Kerry, all members of, and of course there they bow before a replica of Lucifer. You can see it. Don't have to take my word for it. We got a great 4-tape set on the Skull and Bones. We've got a great 4-tape set on the Bilderbergers. We've got a great 4-tape set on the Bohemian Grove. And if you haven't seen the DVD on the Bohemian Grove that Alex Jones shot, where you'll see the leaders of our country with their hoods and their gowns and their candles and carrying out a feigned human sacrifice. A feigned human sacrifice at the Bohemian Grove. The four tape sets on the Bilderbergers, the Bohemian Grove, and of course the Skull and Bones, all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. We have Satanists working at the highest levels of our government today. Please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection.